Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Races Formula E podcast as we look back on a contentious London E-Prix. Formula E's return to London at the Excel Arena provided a variety of hot topics both on and off track, packing in more drama and intrigue than an episode of EastEnders. Oh, blimey, Coxbarrett. Joining me, Andrew Vandenberg, to make sense of it all is our special guest, who today is joining us all the way from California. It's BMW iAndretti team principal, Roger Griffiths. Also, with us as usual, is the racist Formula E writer, Sam Smith, who I like to think of very much as the Chaz to my Dave on this London-flavoured podcast. Sam, we haven't rehearsed this, but if I say rabbit, what are you going to do?
Rabbit and tinkle some ivories, yeah.
That works as poorly as I imagined it might do. But let's officially welcome Roger, who's had a fascinating career that's seen him start off with Ray Mallock Limited in 1996 before he worked in sports cars for Ascari in 2001. He then became a technical director of Honda Performance Development in 2010, where he managed its IndyCar and sports car programs. 4 years later, he joined Andretti Autosport as director of motorsport development, where he took on the Formula E program as team principal and chief technical officer. He also had a notable stint as chairman of the Formula E Teams Association from 2016 to 2018. Roger, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, and hello to both of you. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. As is tradition, I'll ask Sam for a quick character reference. So, Sam, where did you begin when recalling your first meeting with Roger?
Oh, it was many moons ago, actually, when Roger was working for Ascari in what was then, I think, the FIA Sports Car Championship for a short period. Quite a unique program that, Roger, wasn't it?
And I think that's the kindest way of explaining it.
yes, it was interesting days, and I guess really we're both at the sort of reasonably the start of our career. So yeah, kind of lost touch when he was over in the States. Although saw him occasionally at an IMSA racer too, I think, and then obviously reconnected in Formula E, and he's been an ever present. So very slick operation that they've run in Formula E ever since the start. First as Andretti, and then of course with the technical type with BMW from season 5 onwards. So always a pleasure to speak to Roger and get on top of what's going on at the sharp end.
Excellent, Sam. Well, I think before we get into the nitty-gritty of picking apart those two races, I think we need to talk about the venue itself. This was a much-anticipated, long-awaited fixture in the calendar. I think it was first announced back in February 2019, but it was something that I had been aware of back when I was working in Formula E in 2014 or so. Roger, as an exiled Brit, but one with a team based in the UK, was this a kind of home race for you? And what did you make of the facility and the event overall?
Definitely a home race. I mean, I think we're actually enjoying three home venues back to back to back between New York City, London, and then Berlin in a couple of weeks' time. So, you know, the team has quite a strong British contingent, obviously one British driver as well, me at the helm. Really happy to be back racing in London. I think we all missed it from, you know, the first go round at Battersea Park, and to come back to the Excel Centre, I mean, I think it was something that we were all a little interested to see how it was going to unfold. But I think Formula E put on a great show. We can be critical about perhaps the track layout and the fact that it, you know, to some extent, a little part of it was a little bit racing in a car park, but by and large, I think the venue was unbelievable, and certainly in terms of what we did inside. You know, you had no idea that Formula E were going to put this on. We just, you know, we were somewhat circumspect about the inside part, what the pit lane would be like, what the facilities would be like. But all in all, I think a great venue. I mean, obviously there's opportunities for improvement, but I think Formula E and us as well learnt a lot over the course of the weekend about, you know, how to run a venue like this. We'd always talked about, I mean, even dating back to my time at Fatama, you know, the challenges of cities racing, and, you know, sometimes things just don't go to plan. And whether or not we could use sporting arenas as a venue. And I think what Formula E demonstrated over the weekend, that this is truly viable So very pleased with the way it went. And I, you know, even with the new track surface that they put down on the inside, you know, I thought that worked super well compared to some of the temporary tarmacs that have gone down in other places, whether Formula E or otherwise, when we've had issues with track breaking up and all that kind of thing. I mean, we certainly, the track surface itself, I think, was probably the least of our worries. So very, very happy with the way it went. And obviously for us, it was quite a successful weekend as well.
Yeah, I have to say, as someone who'd been at more autosport shows than I care to remember, and having watched all the live action arena stuff, I was sort of dreading the thought of the sound of tyres on that surface that they have there. But I thought they did an amazing job with that track surfacing. And actually, your esteemed colleague and our business correspondent, Jim Wright's written a piece about judging this not on the event that's taken place itself, but on the potential of the event as a whole. And I think that's enormous. And Sam, you've sort of hinted that you think this could become a flagship event for Formula E as well.
Yeah, I think it can be for several reasons. I think, as Roger alluded to, the potential is massive. I mean, the thing that really let it down, of course, was the fact that there was no engagement with the fans. There was a small amount of VIPs and some fans that were allowed outside, but inside it was, I kind of felt it was, and I wrote this, that it was like a long planned wedding that you turned up to and it was an empty church. It just kind of, there was a bit of a soulless element to it. They did a great job, as Roger said as well, on the show and the fireworks and the pyrotechnics and everything, but actually, you know, that was for a couple of minutes, wasn't it? Other than that, you did feel there was a bit of a lack of atmosphere, but that will come. And I think that what they can really expand upon is the off-track stuff as well. So there is a massive scope for business conferences, for exhibitions. That there's so much space on the adjoining hall as well, which I noticed was not being used at the weekend. And additionally, yes, the track needs some improvement. I think everybody's agreed on the fact that those switchback hairpins at turn 10 and 11 were not great. I think that was that's the last time that we'll see them, hopefully, and they can be changed. I think, you know, we found out on Sunday, speaking to Ollie McCrudden, who was very much at the forefront of the event and leading the whole organisation of it, was that the work that's going to be carried out in the Eastern car park there will give scope for more room and more creativity in terms of making the track a little less fiddly and a little less sort of go-karty in terms of those hairpins. So if they make those changes, and obviously if this wretched pandemic grinds to a halt, or just everyone gets on top of it and we can have live events again, which seems to be happening pretty quickly now, then next July, I think we'll have a great carnival atmosphere, as well as the other things I mentioned, such as the business conferences. So I think it can be a flagship event, and where better than London to have that? I thought, yeah, I just think the potential is enormous for it, and they have a 5-year contract.
Well, it would be great to go chronologically into the races, but as regular listeners with this will know, we've been toying with the format, and it's almost in a free form state at the moment. So I think we'll probably kick off with what I penned on social media as the Lucas loophole. Roger, you saw what Audi tried. Was that something that was on your radar, or were you completely surprised at what they tried to do?
Definitely it wasn't on our radar. I mean, all credit to them for trying. You know, in some ways I am glad it didn't succeed, not just because of you know, it would have been one less spot that we made up in terms of the race win or the race finish, but you know, it's not a great way to showcase Formula E and how races can be won. So you know, all credit to them for trying. Technically, yes, it's legal, but you know, in terms of sporting fairness, I thought it didn't really succeed in that respect.
Sam, what did you make of it? If Lucas had managed to stop for a solid second, would that have made a mockery of the whole event?
I think most of all, Audi tried something which I think others could and would have tried. It didn't succeed. I'll come. I'll come to what I feel about the philosophy of it shortly. But first off, I think we need to understand the lay of the land a bit, because we've managed to uncover a fair bit of prehistory to this incident, which wasn't known about in the immediate aftermath. I mean, the possibility of cutting through the pit lane to gain an advantage has been going on for ages. I mean, Mahindra and Nissan tried it last season in Berlin under full course yellow, and that regulation was then changed so that you had to stop for 10 seconds in the pit, effectively, which made that obsolete. That was just no point in doing that anymore. But crucially, the FIA did not address the same scenario under safety car. And what we found out today is that the whole topic was pointed out to the FIA earlier this year. We think it was in De Rio, but we're not sure. Anyway, we've had it corroborated by various teams that they did suggest that this could happen. And it was, although nothing was agreed, it was kind of, you know, in the spirit of the race and of the championship, it was kind of frowned upon. So when you take all that into consideration, and it's understood by all at that meeting that it wasn't a good idea, you then ask yourself, well, why wasn't that addressed in London? Because the teams do their simulations and they know exactly the timing of when they can come in and what they can gain. That wasn't discussed at the team managers meeting last Thursday, as far as we know. Now, think of that what you will, but it's not a great look. I mean, Audi tried it. They almost, I mean, it was within 2 or 3 kilometres per hour of doing it. I mean, Lucas just had a slight slide on that shinier surface as opposed to the epoxy sand surface on the actual racetrack itself. So it's not a great look for a world championship, especially when manufacturers are paying what we believe is €300,000 per season for the privilege of taking part in this new world championship. Then what we get is the governing body saying that they are under-resourced at the same time, and that, you know, they're not able to go into these details. I just find it a bit confusing, really. But back to Audi and their move with Degrassi. I mean, my opinion was at the time, and still is, that they exploited a loophole and took a huge gamble, and it was a cute thing to do, and that it was risky as well. It was a huge risk because there was no knowing if the red light would come on at the end of the pit lane, which, you know, the FIA are equally able to do. It wasn't as if they were down in 20th or 21st position with nothing to lose. Degrassi was in a decent 8th position when he pitted, and he risked losing that. And in the end, he did lose it all because they didn't execute it properly. It paid off massively, and he was in line to achieve, well, temporarily it paid off massively, and he was in line to achieve what in my mind would have been the cutest ever race win. I mean, it would have been unbelievable. But he just didn't stop those wheels in motion. And ultimately, I think Formula E dodged a massive bullet, really, and the FIA dodged a big bullet last weekend, because if he had have executed that win, all hell would have broken loose. It depends which side you are coming from, really, but the fact remains that it's another bit of evidence to suggest that the regs need sorting out. And we have written on the race, we have written this since the end of last year, that these holes in the regulations keep getting exploited. And in this case, they did pretty spectacularly, which is why the FIA have said that they will address this and do it properly, probably with a red light rule in Berlin. But, you know, it's a simple solution to a fairly simple problem in our eyes. But I don't think it would have been great, but you can't blame Audi for having a go. And the fact that they're leaving Formula E at the end of the season, I don't really buy much of that they didn't have anything to lose, and it, you know, they weren't bothered about the reputation of the championship. I don't think that comes into it. I just think that they saw a chance to get Lucas into the top three of the championship, and ultimately it didn't quite work. But these things in racing are, you know, fine, very, very fine, fine lines of judgment. And it didn't quite work this time.
You expecting a rules clarification ahead of Berlin, Roger?
Yeah, I would have thought so. It would be disappointing if they didn't address it. What they ultimately end up doing, I'm not sure. I mean, we've talked about the pros and cons of closing the pits, which is something, you know, coming from IndyCar racing, we're very familiar with. In the past, there's been reluctance to do that because teams have said that, you know, there's an opportunity to pit and repair a damaged car, whether it's a tire, a front wing, or whatever. you know, there's nothing to stop you actually pitting under a closed pit. You just pay a penalty for it when it goes green again. So, you know, you still could come in and repair the car, but you're just likely to have to do a drive-through once it goes green again. You know, the simpler thing could be that they just carry over the same regulation that they do under full course yellow as they do for safety car. You know, it's from my perspective, it's always good to have consistent regulations regardless of the circumstances. So if you have one rule for one thing and one rule for something else, that can get a little bit confusing as well. But I fully anticipate that we won't be allowed that opportunity to try something like that again in Berlin.
Well, once the post-race machinations had played out swiftly, fortunately, it was Alex Lynn that's won. I have to give a quick shout out to our last guest on this podcast, James Roster, who called it. So thanks, James. I'll give you a prize in Berlin. But Sam, it's been a really weird journey for Alex Lynn in Formula E, from that sensational debut to, you know, continually seeming to be in and out of drives. Is this enough to get him a seat for next season?
Yeah, it's a very good point. We do know that Oliver Rowland obviously has already agreed to join Mahindra, so there is a 3-2 situation there, which will keep Dilbag Gill on it for the next few weeks, I'm sure. I mean, personally speaking, I think it was a really well-deserved victory for Alex. When you look at his Formula E career, it's been a fractured one, and largely due to some circumstances beyond his control. I spoke to him about this time last year after Dilbag Gill made the decision to sign him for Berlin, effectively replacing Pascal Wehrlein there. And honestly, I've never conversed with a more focused and determined driver. He was so hungry at that stage after the disappointment of not getting that Jaguar drive for season six. He had a really awful start in Durier, of course, and landed on his head after that shunt. And he's come back excellently. The Mahindra is a nice, it's quite a nimble car, but it has this propensity to overheat its rear tyres, which is precisely what happened in Saturday's race, and lost some pace. And saw him shuffle back from the lead to third place, and obviously Jake Dennis took advantage of that. But 24 hours later, he was terrific. The fact that it all happened a stone's throw from where he was born in Romford was a really nice storyline. I think he brings a lot to a team, Alex. He's got the best years of his career ahead of him actually now, and I think he, if that includes Formula E, great. I hope it does. I hope he gets a seat, but it could easily involve a manufacturer driving sports cars, which he's done before, of course, with Aston Martin very successfully, or even IndyCars. I think he'd do a really good job over there too. In relation to the 3-2 situation at Mahindra, you know, it's hard to see how that's going to go, but word is that it may well be Alex that loses out, but we've still got to see on that one. I think he'd be an excellent long-term choice for Nissan. I certainly see, we certainly know that there are talks going on there, but Alex Albon is also speaking to Nissan about a drive. And as we mentioned, Lucas de Grasse's representatives also sort of dangled some carrots Nissan's way too with Lucas. But we'll have to see. I think Lucas is certainly the rank outsider there, and Alex Albon or Alex Lynn, one of the Alexes, could get the drive there. So, but yeah, we'll just have to keep tabs on that one in the coming weeks.
Roger, the race on Sunday saw quite a few more incidents and a bit more rough and tumble that we'd seen in the Saturday race with Lotterer and Buemi in particular picking up penalties. Why do you think that was?
I think we've seen that play out before in the past, to be honest, with the double headers. Saturday's race generally is a little bit more respectful. I think the drivers are somewhat mindful of the fact that they have to go racing again the following day. And if they do something too reckless, which leads to significant damage, then there's a possibility they're not going to be out there on Sunday. I think also they've understood how the track has evolved during the course of a race. I mean, when they went into Saturday's race, they didn't know how well it would race. And I think with that piece of knowledge in mind, they started to understand where the overtaking opportunities were. I was quite surprised in the step change in the driving standard, if you like. We fell foul of that, to be honest. you know, some drivers certainly have a reputation of being quite aggressive, getting their elbows out, as people like to say. Not sure that it's altogether great for what Formula E is trying to do, but I think it's the nature of the double headers. The second race does tend to be a little bit more eventful. You know, fortunately, looking forward to the season 8 calendar, we don't have at the moment quite as many of those planned as we've experienced this past season.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think those moves, the two ones I highlighted in particular, painted Formula E in the professional light and did a disservice to the quality of driving on the grid. I think there is a solid case for it being along with IndyCar having the best field outside of F1, but sometimes they don't make themselves look like that. And I think maybe a solid slap on the wrist might do something about that. We saw the Mercedes EQ back to their early season form. You know, they scored 8 points from 6 races prior to Excel and then 45 points in 2 races. Does that really just sum up this whole season in one little acorn?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody would have written Mercedes off, or if you had done, you'd have been completely stupid. I mean, you know that they have a good package. I mean, you saw that package win in Pueblo with a Montara. We know the car's good. We know that the drivers are supremely confident and very capable. We know it's a good team. So none of those pieces change from, you know, the beginning of the season and through the middle part of the season. I think sometimes you can just be a victim of circumstance and things just go wrong for you. You know, with the drivers scoring well initially, they were in the group one, and we all know how challenging that can be in qualifying. And then the knock-on effect of what that means in terms of how you end up racing. So I you know, it didn't surprise me that Mercedes came back stronger. I was probably surprised it hadn't happened earlier, but we know that, you know, the leadership within there as team principal is very strong. We know they've got great engineers, so I'm sure they were working through all of the different scenarios. And it was, to me, it was just, you know, you never write them off any weekend. And I think it was, you know, just time for them to come back.
Sam, I couldn't help but feel sorry for Stoffel Vandoorne. He looked to have it in the bag, and then it all sort of went wrong for him. What did you make of how he came a cropper?
Yeah, it was a shame, wasn't it? He set a stunning qualifying lap on Sunday and cruised to a terrific pole, and then looked really in control in the first half of the race. I mean, it was teeing up nicely for Mercedes to choreograph that one and get a 1-2, but ultimately Oliver Rowland, he just made an honest mistake. I mean, he hit a bump and locked his brakes and clouted Vandoorne. Apologised sincerely afterwards, but of course it was little recompense for Vandoorne. And you have to say, it looks like that the title's looking difficult for him now. He's 32 points in any other championship, you'd say no chance, you know, he's out of it. But of course, it could well be that at the second race in Berlin, you know, he could be riding shotgun for De Vries and been a weapon for De Vries. So we'll have to see. After this season, though, you wouldn't bet against him winning on Saturday, because don't forget he's in Group 3.
No, absolutely.
And and then it's all to play for again, isn't it? I mean, it'd just be like 2021, where he wins on the Saturday, the top 8 in the points fail to score, and he's right back in the title mix again with sort of 7 points in arrears. So we'll have to see, but I did feel sorry for him in Sunday. I think he deserved more, and he came back from that shunt in free practice, didn't he, on Saturday morning, where he aquaplaned into the wall. So he clawed it back nicely, got some points on Saturday, should have got a hatful on Sunday. But the lad from Barnsley had other ideas on that one.
Another driver who was a bit out of luck was a reigning champion, Da Costa. He'd shown that you could race hard and overtake in a clean manner around that track, only for Lotterer to put paid to that.
Yeah, it was a bit of an outrageous bit of defending there from Andre. He does have a reputation for being hard, but usually reasonably fair. I mean, it's right on the line with Lotterer sometimes. But I think on that occasion, it was fairly clear that he'd made at least one too many move and essentially put Da Costa into the wall. Yes, Antonio could have lifted, but you know the move was already committed to, and moving across, no, that was an absolute slam dunk of a penalty, and I believe that Lotterer has since privately messaged Da Costa and offered his apologies as well, which have been accepted. So you'd expect that from two great professionals such as those two. But again, for Da Costa, he was absolutely rapid in that race. He rose from the back of the grid or near the back of the grid and made great progress and was into the top 10. He could have got 8 points last weekend, which would have put him right on De Vries's tail. And I just get the feeling that potentially that could have been a season-defining incident that he came on the wrong side of. But at the same time, I've always said that if Da Costa was 12 points behind anyone going into Berlin, when you consider what he achieved in Berlin last season, then he would be the favourite, irrespective of what qualifying group he's in. Now, he's now fifth in the championship, and he's 15 points behind Nyck de Vries. But I still think it's entirely possible that he could still retain his title. But we're just going to have to see with the track conditions and how the evolution works on that crucial Saturday at Tempelhof.
Roger, we've had you on the show for a while now. We haven't talked about your team. a genuinely really positive weekend, a second win for Jake Dennis and a third for the team this season. I've been very impressed by the way Jake's taken to Formula E. You feel the same way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always knew that it was going to be, you know, tough initially, because we've seen that many times with a rookie driver coming into the championship, and in, you know, Jake's case, having been out of single-seaters for quite some while. But, you know, impressed with what we saw from him in testing and what he'd done on the simulator. So we knew that it was just a matter of time. And I think Jake himself was quite surprised by the intensity of the racing in Formula E. He's had a bit of bad luck with, you know, one or two small technical issues that haven't gone his way. He's been on the receiving end of Pascal Wehrlein on two occasions, I think. But I think once he gets a clean practice qualifying, then, you know, he's very strong. And I, in both the race win in Valencia and also here in London, he's demonstrated a very calm head under pressure, just got out there, got his head down and got on with it. And, you know, what he did on Saturday, being able to pull a 5 second gap and then just hold it there and manage the pace of the race, manage the tyres, etc. It was just, you know, very mature from my perspective.
We've seen this phenomenal ebb and flow as the championship's gone on across the season, mainly due to the qualifying system. Do you now start to simulate what relative things that might happen across, especially race one, and how that might affect you for race two for Berlin now? Do you go into that mode?
I mean, we'll look at it, but it's not the priority as far as I'm concerned. The priority is making sure that we have the best cars available for both drivers on for both races. I think if you try and get too cute with what you're doing in terms of strategy and, you know, should we give up a position so we slip back into the second group of qualifying rather than, you know, hold those extra points and finish in the top six for the following day. I think there's potentially more to trip yourself up over by trying to go down that route than just to focus on getting as many points as possible on every occasion that's presented to you. So I think that's my preferred route. You know, we'll see how it evolves. I think, you know, we will need to look at what we're doing with our two drivers independent, you know, when they're together. And, you know, if they are one behind the other, or and there's an opportunity to perhaps move one ahead of the other one, which makes an impact to the championship standings, and I think that's something we will consider. But no, I don't think we're going to try and get too smart, because usually when you do that, it always backfires on yourself.
Yeah, I think you can end up double bluffing yourself, can't you, Sam? with 14 points behind De Vries, how do you rate Jake's championship chances?
Well, on form, he does have a chance, doesn't he? He was terrific in London. He's had some strong races leading up to that since that breakthrough victory in Valencia. But in Formula E, as we know, form is so bloody temporary, isn't it? I mean, it's he's in Group 1 for the first time this season. Is it for the first time, Roger?
It was Group 1 on Sunday.
Of course, yeah. So he's staying in Group 1, which will obviously be super tough, but you can overtake at Tempelhof. So it could easily come back to him more than it has at other races for drivers that have been compromised in Group 1 qualifying. You have to say he's been incredibly impressive, as Roger said, this season, because this time last year, I'm pretty sure he hadn't driven a Formula E car. So when you take that into consideration, I think he's done more than a solid job, a really impressive job for a rookie. What I like about him is you get the impression he doesn't overthink everything, which I think some drivers have the tendency to do. He seems to have a natural aptitude for getting on with it and getting things done, and not many mistakes. I can't count many mistakes this season. And as Roger said, the races he hasn't finished or been compromised, and it's usually been down to a glitch of some description, or it's been Pascal Wehrlein. So I think very impressive. Part of me says it's a stretch to think that he could win the thing, but look, this season is so hard to forecast or predict that if he ultimately, I think if he finished in the top five or six of the championship, that is a mega achievement anyway. I think anything above that is stratospheric, really. So it'll be interesting to see what he does in Berlin, but he's got the temperament for it. But crucially, of course, he hasn't been to Tempelhof, which is such a quirky place to go, whereas three quarters of the grid, obviously, probably a bit more, have been there and know the quirks of that surface and how things play out over a few laps. So, but we'll see.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm actually quite excited about the fact that he's never been there, because, I mean, with the exception of our race win with Max, I think it was the second one last year, it's been a bit of our Achilles heel, that track. And I'm curious to see how somebody that's zero experience will go there. So for me, I don't think that's an issue. I think the one thing that we're trying to do as a team is we're not talking about championships. You know, we're not saying, oh, we've got a shot at winning the championship here. I mean, we know how up and down Formula E can be. So we're not trying to put that pressure on him. We're just treating it one race at a time and let's see what we can do.
Well, given you sort of alluded to it, was it season 3 when you had an absolute stinker there?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was kind of, yeah, it was, you know, it was a really tough event for the team. You know, when you think about the quality of the driver lineup we had as well with Antonio and Robin Fridge, it was a real shock to us. We also learnt a lot from it. I think that was really the first event where I believe it was Mahindra got the drop on all of us about how to manage the tyres in qualifying. And that was something that we all learned from, and they did such a better job than the rest of us. But yeah, it was pretty grim.
Talking of pretty grim, ahead of the event, Jaguar's big home event for them, Sam, but they ended up with very little at an event where they had a very quick car.
Yeah, another messy one for Jags. Again, the victim of circumstance on Saturday with that really pathetic accordion-type shunt, which affected, well, retired Bird and affected Evans, of course. Then you got the feeling, well, maybe it's ripe for a great birdie fight back on Sunday, but it never really materialised. And he ultimately wiped out Norman Nato and a load of banners in that the turn 10 wall, that ridiculous hairpin, as we mentioned at the top of the show, and he's got a 3-place grid penalty for Berlin, actually. So yeah, a bit of salt in the wounds there for Sam. It was a big shame, because even a few points from that race would have helped him big time going into Berlin, I suppose. Mitch Evans, really strong Sunday, and he, I thought he ran a really smart race, actually. He seemed a little disappointed at the end, which I wasn't quite sure about, but he needn't have been, because I thought it was a really good drive, which had the feel of a I don't know, something that there's something I can't quite put my finger on, but Mitch has had so many disappointments recently. It would just be like this season, wouldn't it, that he's ultimately the champion after what happened in New York, and again a disappointment in London. I think he's got a really good chance. He and Jags have a huge point to prove after that damp squib of a performance in Berlin last August, when they were initially pretty baffled as to what had happened. I know they've been working mega hard to try and overturn those issues, and they did a lot of testing and sim work with Temple Hof in mind. They've not acquired the facility, but they have a sort of semi-permanent facility at Abingdon Airfield, which obviously has certain natural similarities to Temple Hof in the fact that it's an airfield. So that could be quite an interesting topic heading into the final two races. So I suppose after Rossiter became some kind of Nostradamus last time on this podcast, I'm gonna say that the Kiwi will bear some fruit, let's say, in Tempelhof.
Roger, Tempelhof will be BMW's last event as an official Formula E partner. Is there anything special planned? And now would be a really good time, if you're so minded, to give us a scoop on what the team's up to next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as far as Tempelhof goes, I think BMW have some plans. They haven't necessarily shared them with us at this stage, but I think they want to leave Formula E as friends. They want to, show their commitment, that they've had really from season one. I mean, they've been part of it for the last 7 years. I think they've got some activities planned. I mean, obviously at the moment, everything is muted because of the pandemic that we're dealing with. And I know that they've been talking about some sort of private events just with the team, because we've all been together. I mean, as I think I've alluded to on a couple of occasions, our journey with BMW started at the very second race of Formula E in Malaysia. And, a few of us have been through the whole journey together. And, I expect that, we're all friends and, colleagues as well. And I expect there will be it'll be quite sad at the end of it, but moving on to season eight, we've got things are falling into place quite nicely, I would say. 2-3 weeks ago, the job list was looking pretty long, but now I've been able to tick a few things off. I think we've done a lot of good work on the recruitment of some technical staff to replace what we're losing from BMW, recruiting some very competent engineers for various positions. I think we are starting to narrow down on where we're headed with the driver lineup. We had a very successful weekend in New York, not just on track, but also off track, with prospective commercial guests that we had at there. People that came away super impressed with what they saw from Formula E, people that really had no experience of Formula E before. It's looking quite positive, I would say. I think over the next few weeks, you'll start to see some announcements coming from the team about what season eight is going to look like, and potentially beyond season eight as well, because it's been a kind of a double-pronged attack with, the short term of one remaining season of Gen 2 and how that's going to look, but also where we as a team stand as we look further ahead to Generation 3 and what that will look for us. So it's been very busy, but I think we've been making some really good progress. So hopefully in the next coming weeks and months, there's going to be some exciting announcements from us about what it is we're doing and who we're doing it with.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing that in due course. Sam, you're always putting our guests on the spot. Now, with 16 drivers in contention for the championship still, how do you see Berlin playing out, at least from a tactical position, in that first Saturday race?
Well, one of the things which I find interesting, and Roger touched on it earlier, is if there's the possibility of this kind of synchronization or even dropping points to get into an advantageous qualifying group. We've already seen it, as we mentioned in the last podcast. Oliver Rowland dropped a position in the first race at New York behind his teammate, Sebastian Buemi, so that he dropped into group two, sacrificing a couple of points there. Now, that ultimately went against him because there was that rain shower in the following qualifying session, which kind of ruined that plan to some degree. And that is the risk, isn't it? If something, a variable comes to pass where it isn't beneficial to actually be in group two, heading into that second race on the Sunday in Tempelhof, it can easily backfire. You can't forecast how things are going to pan out. And also, I imagine if you miss the title by a point or 2 points that you sacrificed in the previous race, you know, you're not going to be able to live with yourself, really. And the permutations are going to get super tricky. It's going to be hard to see. It's hard to predict exactly what will happen, you know, but knowing the evolution of the Berlin track a little bit, and it's not been massively consistent in terms of the degree to how the track has evolved during qualifying in the past, and we've only had one event, shall we say, albeit multiple races last year on the track, because they had three configurations last year. They're going to reverse the track this year. We think it's going to be the conventional track that is used, that is then reversed for the second race. And we know there are so many quirks with that surface, this very unique surface at Tempelhof. So you put all that into the mix, and you know, God knows. I mean, I'll stick with Mitch Evans. I've gone with it now. I've committed. So I'm going to say that Mitch Evans is going to come out on top. I can't tell you how he'll come out on top, because I'm sure there'll be so many. There'll be more twists and turns than a let's go back to the EastEnders thing, shall we? There'll be more plot twists than EastEnders going on at Tempelhof. But listen, I don't. I think the engineers are going to have a super, super tough job. And, you know, I don't envy some of the decisions that are going to have to be made on choreography, on potentially, you know, you could easily tie yourself in knots. So I don't envy anyone associated with a title challenger heading into Sunday.
I think the key to track evolution in Berlin will be the decision whether they sweep the track between FP2 and qualifying. I think if they leave the track alone and don't touch it, then we won't see so much track evolution, because we talk about the surface, but it, you know, it really chews up the tires and it puts a lot of debris offline. But when they send the sweepers out, what they tend to do is, yes, they're picking up the bigger bits of rubber, but then they're just spreading all of the smaller stuff all over the racing line. So group one really suffers and ends up being that vacuum cleaner. So if the track ends up being left alone, which is what we've requested, then I think group one has a better shot. If they sweep the track, then, you know, group one's going to be a write-off.
Roger, is the track surface as aggressive in both directions? So is it the same? Or
even... Yeah, it's the same. I mean, there are, obviously it loads the car on the opposite side, you know, depending which way you're going, but it really doesn't make a lot of difference as to which way round you go. So it just tears the tires up quite a lot. It's particularly with these big long corners, you know, turn one, for example, is very long corner. You know, that really beats the tires up. So it's the combined, you know, when you get, we talk about combined corners when you're either braking and carrying a lot of lateral load or accelerating and carrying a lot of lateral load. That's when the tires start to suffer. And it's, you know, particularly we start to see in qualifying, if you don't prepare well, if you overdrive, if you do an outbuild push style qualifying lap, if you overdrive your build lap, you put too much energy into the tire, and then by the time you get to sector three, you know, sector one and sector two will be good because the tires will be hot, but by the time you get to sector three on your flying lap, they'll have overheated, and you know, you're going to end up a long way down that sector time, and it could all fall apart for you.
It's going to be fascinating to watch that play out. Something that's playing out at a much, much slower rate, Sam, is the Mercedes decision on committing to Gen 3. Are they ever going to make one?
Yeah, time's ticking, isn't it? It's gone on and on. We believe they had a preliminary meeting on the 15th of July, but no decision was made. Ian James told me in London that that it is imminent. We don't know if it's going to be before or during Berlin. We don't know what the decision is going to be. Depending on who you speak to, it could be a complete 50-50 that the Daimler board are going to sanction an extension into the third rule set. Nobody genuinely really knows, apart from, well, probably not even yet the executives there. If it is a thumbs down and Mercedes aren't going to continue into Gen 3, I believe that there will be a plan B, that there will be a rescue package of some description. And we've got a story on that this week on the-race.com. So you'll be able to read a little bit about what might be the worst case scenario and the life raft and the rescue package coming out for Mercedes. Hopefully that doesn't come to pass and they do continue. I mean, when you look at where Mercedes and what Mercedes are doing in the automotive industry, to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that they would withdraw after just a couple of seasons or three seasons as it would be. But we'll have to wait and see. As we know, major manufacturers do make pretty snap decisions as Roger can attest. But this has always happened in racing, hasn't it? This is the way people know the rules. People know how big OEMs can make decisions based on things that generally, you know, we might not know about. So we'll have to wait and see.
Roger, we were treated to a nice presentation from the new Cape Town delegation over the weekend. And on the face of it, they sound like really exciting plans. So what you've have you made from what you've seen and heard of that so far?
No, I mean, I'm super excited with the opportunity to go race in South Africa. I mean, I think the backdrop of the ocean down there, and it is a very exciting city. I think it will be a great venue. I always love the fact that Formula E's been able to typically introduce one or two new venues into the calendar each year. I think it adds an exciting element that spices up the championship. I think what was presented is exciting in terms of what they're prepared to do for the venue and the activation around it. So yeah, I personally, I think it's going to be one of my personal highlights of the season 8 championship, so looking forward to that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of us have already circled that date in our diary for next year. That's a nice little winter warmer. Sam, it wouldn't be one of these podcasts without having a little driver market update, especially as just before we recorded this, Lucas Degrassi responded to your news that his representatives are talking to Nissan with a sort of non-denial. So give us the latest on that situation.
Yeah, well, as I said before, I think their primary target is Alex Albon, which would be a nice story, wouldn't it? Sort of going full circle there after he was meant to drive in season 5. Yeah, Lucas is on the market. He says he's 90% sure he's going to be in a seat next season, which I think is great for the overall championship. I only see really two positions available to him, probably Nissan and Venturi, or maybe we shouldn't discount Andretti. I don't know. We can't see Roger's face at this stage, but there is a team based in Monaco, right, which is where Lucas lives. So that would be a nice, easy commute for him. But we'll have to see. This is all obviously speculation at this stage, but I don't see any particularly any other doors opening at this point in time. Other than that, it's reasonably static. We believe that several teams will confirm that they are sort of staying as they are at the minute, including Envision, Virgin and probably Jaguar as well in the coming weeks, potentially before Berlin. And then you've got the what you sort of call the lottery seats, really, with Dragon and Neo 333, which I think will probably be known a bit later on in the off season. So yeah, there were some rumours about Nyck de Vries going to Williams F1 potentially, which you could see happening. And I don't think Ian James or Toto Wolff, Ian James would stand in the way of that happening.
Oh, every driver with a super license has been linked to that Williams seat.
Yeah, indeed.
Has James still got his super license?
Jev?
No, James Rossiter. I mean, probably even
oh, James. James, probably. Yeah, I would imagine. And
that's why I keep on the list as well of potential candidate.
Well, he's good at forecasting other drivers' careers, isn't he? He should stick to forecasting his own, I suppose. But no, I think Mercedes, you know, who knows? But I really don't see many other changes. I think the areas of interest are obviously with our present guest and his team. I think that's going to be really interesting to see what Andretti do in the coming weeks and months, and then who's going to get that seat if Red Bull are going to allow Albon to enter into Formula E. So yeah, that's about it.
I was leaving a nice little pause there in case Roger wanted to interject with some breaking news, but I'm not going to push him on it, and we'll wait for our briefing in due course. Well, that's it for another fantastic episode. Thank you, Roger, for your lucid answers and joining us, and I look forward to catching up with you in Berlin and maybe sharing a stein of beer on BMW's ticket if they're going to be celebrating like that.
Right, put it this way, if the tab is going to be on them, I think we all should have a few more than just the one beer.
Absolutely. And as ever, you can catch all of Sam's news from the FE paddock on the-race.com. And don't forget to check out our other podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, which is here for its fourth series and is chugging along. And also, while I'm on, given I have a bigger role in the race, just a huge thank you to everyone that's been involved in our podcasting. We did our 2 millionth download of the F1 podcast last week, I think it was, which is a phenomenal achievement in the 18 months or so that we've been around. So just thank you for everyone who's been a fan of ours, and we look forward to doing more in the future. Bye-bye.